Have you ever had a burning question about the Bible, theology, or the Christian faith? One you wish you could ask a world-renowned scholar? Now's your chance. On Ask NT Wright Anything, Professor Tom Wright tackles your biggest faith questions, and we want to hear yours. Submit your question today at premierinsight.org/NTW, and you might hear it answered in an upcoming episode. It's that easy. Visit premierinsight.org/NTW now and be part of the conversation.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're very pleased to say we have a guest on the show today, which is Graham Tomlin. Hi, Graham.
Hi, Tim. Hi, John. Very nice to see you today and good to be on the podcast. Yeah.
Thanks very much for coming on, Graham. For those who haven't come across you before, would you mind doing a kind of very brief potted history and then we'll delve in a bit deeper in a second?
Yeah, sure. Well, where do I start? I was born in Bristol in the West Country, grew up there and got ordained in the Church of England. Spent most of my ministry and academic life teaching theology, both in Oxford and then later on in London, because I moved to London in 2005 to set up what became St. Mellitus College. And so I spent most of my, let's say, my ministry in academic teaching and theological education, training clergy for the Church of England and lay people in theology. And then moved in 2015, became Bishop of Kensington, which is part of the Diocese of London, was Bishop of Kensington for 7 years. And then just 2.5 years ago, moved to set up a new thing called the Centre for Cultural Witness, which has been based in Lambeth Palace. So we live back in Oxford now and work in London. So it's a little potted history of me. And I'm married, 2 kids, 6, nearly 7 grandchildren. So that's it. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, it's really great to have you on the show, Graham. Thanks so much. And for those who are interested in podcasts and Christianity, which I hope is most of you, Graham is also part of the longstanding God Pod, which I recommend. I'm a listener myself with a few other theologians, which is a good listen if you're interested in going a bit deeper in theology. You mentioned most of your career had been spent in that kind of teaching academic world. How did you find yourself drifting towards that? Was that always part of the plan when you were kind of young adult as a Christian? Or did you sense a kind of sense of call to teach and study?
No, it wasn't part of the original plan at all. I was brought up in a Christian home. My dad was a Baptist minister. And so I kind of grew up as a Christian kid, trusting it all, trusting what your parents tell you, until I hit about sort of 15, 16, when I drifted into, not more than drifted. I think I kind of decided definitely that I was an atheist. I didn't believe a word of it. And went through a number of years of rather precocious and rather pretentious teenage atheism, where I kicked the traces over from what my parents had taught me, much to their, shame, chagrin, or whatever the word might be. Anyway, I often say my teenage atheism or my teenage rebellion was not sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was reading Nietzsche was my way of doing, which may tell you a little bit about myself. But so I was always a bit of a bookish kid. You know, I used to like to read quite a bit. I'm not just bookish. I love my football and everything else as well, but I used to read quite a bit. And so I suppose looking back, you might think maybe it was a bit inevitable I'd end up doing theology. But certainly when I first went into the prospect of getting ordained, I assumed I'd be a vicar for the rest of my days. That's what I went into it for, to get ordained, to become a pastor and a teacher within local parish churches. And it slightly took me by surprise going into theology. I did a theology degree as part of my training for ministry and just absolutely loved it and found it fascinating, just trying to understand the depths of this faith that I'd sort of rejected as a child and rediscovered again as a young adult. And so I did a 3-year curacy in a parish town in Exeter, but after that kind of moved back to Oxford and started teaching and carried on doing it, you know, from ever since then, really. So I've always really found the study of theology fascinating, trying to kind of convey that to other people, trying to help other people understand the kind of the way our faith works. And so so it wasn't inevitable, but it's been a very important part of my journey.
Did you have a sense from the beginning that you wanted the study of theology not to be a kind of ivory tower academic exercise, but you wanted to, you know, pass it on to people, whether that's vicars, trainee vicars, or lay people, or in the local church context as well?
Yeah, but very much so. I mean, I often think my original calling, which was, I think, into pastoral parish ministry, I never quite lost that. I mean, I always felt that you know, I was called by God to help kind of ordinary Christians deepen their faith and understand it better, and as a result, live the Christian faith more authentically. Because I do think the two are related. The more you understand the faith, the more you understand about the way God works and the way God relates to us. Not that we can ever get to the bottom of that. The more that fills you with a sense of wonder, the more it kind of helps you to navigate life well. And so, so it seemed to me the idea of theology, which was purely an ivory tower thing that was done within a university, seemed a bit of a contradiction in terms. One of the people that I did some of my doctoral work on and ended up teaching on quite a lot was Martin Luther, for whom the idea of a theology that doesn't kind of engage the heart and the life is just a nonsense. For him, you know, theology has to be tested in the reality of experience. Otherwise, it's bad theology. If it doesn't help you live well, if it doesn't help you get through suffering, if it doesn't help you kind of answer the tough questions that come at you, it's a pretty useless and probably not a very good theology. And so I think that the people I read like that earlier on were those who were trying to helping me to see a kind of theology that had to be rooted in the lived experience of life and had to kind of survive the rigors of some of the questions that come at you. Otherwise, it's really not worth bothering with.
I mean, would it be true to say, Graham, that a lot of theology, although it tries to engage with quotes, the real life, real world, it's often very privatized. It seems to me, you know, looking in from the outside, that it's often very much about me and my life and my personal relationships. And that many theologians and Bible teachers and so on live in this world, but they don't seem to see it as a priority about how we engage with this vast secular world and culture and civilization and all the civilizations out there. It feels as though a lot of it is within the Christian bubble. I mean, is that fair? Is that a caricature?
It's probably fair of some theology. I think not all. I think there are quite a few theologians who do try quite hard to relate it. I think it's more the problem that the theologians find that difficult to express. Seems to me that, you know, I read a lot of theology and you know, you almost need to be part of the guild to understand the language of what's going on. And if you're used to studying lots of theology with lots of sort of abstract expression, you kind of know what's going on. But if you're not part of it, it can be very hard. So I think it's more the issue. It's not so much that people are not relating theology to wider life, but it's a kind of mode of expression that theologians have, which make it quite difficult to access that from the outside. And I think you're right as well, John. There is some theology that does seem to be, and some preaching that seems to be just purely about my own relationship with God or what happens in the church or anything like that. And actually, that is quite hard to relate to. I mean, I remember coming across a statistic some while ago that said that most people leave the church not because they stop believing in God or because they no longer believe in the resurrection or the incarnation, but they just don't see any relationship at all between what happens in church and what happens outside the church. So, you know, their life, their work, their family, their sport, their interest in arts or books or whatever it might be, seems to bear no relation at all to what they hear in church. And they kind of think one day, hang on, why am I doing this? And so that work of seeking to relate theology and the way God is with the world to the way the world actually works seems to be a crucial thing. And it's part of the nature of theology itself. Again, one of the things I think I learned from my early teachers in theology, reading people like Luther and Calvin, was that, you know, we only have access to God as he reveals himself to us, as he connects himself to us. We don't have access to kind of God as he is in himself, as it were, some abstract, distant understanding of the kind of internal workings of God. We only understand God as he reveals himself, therefore in that connection between sort of God and the world, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, one of my frustrations is that, you know, I came as a young medical student to All Souls Church in the 1970s. John Stott was the rector there, and it was his vision of engaging in the modern world, of as he called it, double listening, of trying to find a bridge between the world of the Christian faith and what was actually happening in the modern world, which to me was the revolutionary thing. You know, I'd had a lot of orthodox conventional Christianity, which I was frankly bored and found irrelevant. And suddenly here was a way of articulating the Christian faith, which seemed absolutely relevant. And it was just spine tingling for me as a young Christian, and has been very influential for me all the way down, you know, 50 years later. And yet, to my frustration, here we are 50 years later, and that kind of preaching still seems incredibly rare. How often do I hear a sermon which really engages with the stuff that's going on out in the real world? So why is that? Why is it that 50 years later we still seem to be? I mean, I'm not blaming you at all. I'm just intrigued in a way, saddened, but intrigued as to why that way of thinking hasn't gained more traction.
Yeah. And I think you're right, John. I think I'm old enough to remember that John Stott's book, was it Issues Facing Issues Christians Facing, Today, which came out in, what, 1980, something like that?
That's right.
Which is quite a revolutionary thing for certainly evangelicals at the time, who didn't really tend to think about ethical issues, some of the kind of knotty problems that were out there in the world. It tended before that to be rather sort of pietistic, kind of ruminations on the spiritual life, on how you pray and, you know, how you evangelize your friends, that kind of thing. And I think, like you, I was rather brought up with that. And actually, it was a bit of a revolution to suddenly find someone like that who was kind of trusted within the evangelical world, who was suddenly thinking, actually, it matters the way we think about these really difficult issues out there in the world. So so I think that is right. I mean, I think one of the reasons why we don't do it too well is because we're not very skilled at how we relate Christian faith to culture and how you'd make that connection. And it may be that it's because, you know, you could see sort of two sides to this, the sort of, you know, the kind of more liberal and the more evangelical kind of approach to it. Sometimes the more liberal approach has tended to kind of take the world as the given thing. You know, what modern science or what modern culture tells you, that's what you take for granted. You don't question that. And you therefore question the scriptures or the kind of tradition of the faith in the light of, you know, sort of the assured results of modern understanding. And maybe evangelicals sometimes react to that by saying, well, okay, so we're not going to go in that direction at all. We're going to sort of hold on to the old truths of the past and not have any, you know, cultural accommodation in that kind of way. But it seems to me neither of those approaches really help us a great deal. It seems to me there is something given about the Christian faith that we have to, you know, the wit that is handed down from time to time. It doesn't mean we, you know, we've got a sort of fixed formula of it. We are going to continually sort of interrogate it and explore it and go deeper into it. But that work of working out, well, what does that Christian faith, what does those great Christian doctrines that we find in the creeds, how do they help you navigate some of the kind of tricky ethical and cultural questions around, seem to be quite crucial. But also the question of, you know, how does the world look when you look at it through Christian eyes? I mean, part of the reason I'm doing what I'm doing right now in terms of the Center for Culture Witness and Seen and Unseen, which is trying to help people look at the world with a different set of spectacles, with Christian spectacles. So you see the Bible not so much just as a text that you read, you know, in the morning and you put it away for the rest of the day, but it becomes like a kind of pair of spectacles that you put on and through which you look at everything as the day goes on. So what does economics and what does Israel-Gaza war, what does Trump's economic policies, what does it all look like when you look at it through Christian eyes, when you see it through the grid, through the kind of lens, if you like, of Christian faith and Christian theology? That seems to be the right use of Christian theology rather than just as something to be studied on its own.
obviously I'm significantly younger than both of you, so I don't recall the 1980 publication of Issues Facing Christians Today. But what I do recall very strongly growing up in All Souls and in the kind of evangelical Anglican subculture in the 90s and 2000s was actually a kind of strange suspicion or even hostility towards theological study, a sense that, you know, you mustn't send your children off to university to study theology because they'll be exposed to these dangerous liberal progressive ideas. Their certainties about scripture and the creed and all this will be shattered and they'll be kind of come back in pieces. And there was a real, an almost kind of anti-intellectualism streak among some evangelicalism. Did you come across that much yourself when you were teaching? Is that partly what you were trying to address with things like Symbolitis?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I do recognise that. And I remember growing up with that same feeling that theology was a kind of bit of a dirty word in the circles I grew up in. The early Bible study was fine, but theology was a bad thing because theology, you know, you could lose your faith if you study theology. And yes, you know, there were stories of people who did exactly that. They went into the study of theology and their faith sort of was crumbled in as a result. And so, and yes, there were teachers of theology, people who taught theology, who did seem to think it was their job to deconstruct the faith of anyone who came along, you know, with a kind of strong personal faith in Christ. But I suppose I think things did begin to change probably in sort of 70s, 80s and 90s a little bit. You began to get sort of figures, I mean, not just like John Stott, but people like some of Tom Wright and others who were coming, who were actually taking biblical studies and theological work quite seriously. You had people like Sir Howard Marshall in Aberdeen as well. You had a number of systematic theologians, people like Alistair McGrath in Oxford, who I work with very closely. Oliver O'Donovan doing his work in ethics. In other words, you had some people who were, you know, clearly, you know, broadly speaking, would own the evangelical label, who were clearly orthodox in their theology, but taking that theology deeply seriously in a way that you probably didn't have in the 1940s and 1950s. So I think, you know, I was kind of maybe the next generation on from that, but was glad to have that sense that actually theology might be a way of actually deepening your faith rather than losing it. And there's an element of risk because when you look into your faith, you never know quite what's going to happen on it. But for me, theology has always been a really enriching experience. It's been something which has just deepened my faith, has given it a colour and a depth and a richness that I think I wouldn't have had without it. So yes, I do recognise that fear of theology. But it seems to me that if you approach it with that determination to, if you like, to pray your way through it, that seems to be prayer and theology work very closely together, but also to see it as a sort of church activity. And one of the other great figures, I think, who helps us in this is Karl Barth, you know, who was obviously a lot earlier than that, and evangelicals often sort of struggled with Karl Barth trying to work out whether he was one of them or not. But it's interesting that, you know, he wrote this great long text called The Church Dogmatics, and he called it The Church Dogmatics, not The Christian Dogmatics, because he felt that dogmatics theology was something that belonged in the church, rather than just a kind of abstract sort of philosophical construct out there that bore no relationship to the church and the lived experience of Christian life. And so it's kind of always been there in the tradition, and I think that's just been rediscovered in more recent times.
And certainly for me, you know, reading theology as an amateur, but really, you know, struggling my way, reading a fair amount of Barth and other O'Donovan and others, I would certainly echo that. It's actually very much strengthened and deepened my own faith as I've seen its intellectual power and integrity and persuasiveness. And all truth is God's truth, and therefore we should never be frightened of engaging with the truth. I suppose I'm also aware, I think, that one of the besetting sins of theologians is a kind of intellectual arrogance. You know, I'm going to sort this out by sheer intellectual horsepower. And I recognise that because it's a besetting sin of doctors as well.
Thankfully, never journalists.
No, journalists don't suffer in this way. But I think, therefore, there is a kind of intellectual humility You know, that trembles before the living God.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there is a, I mean, it's one of the areas where I you know, I'm conscious of my own evangelical background can be a bit, I think the reason why evangelicals were sometimes a bit nervous about doing theology was because in some ways they weren't Catholic enough. What I mean by that is that evangelicals can tend to be a little bit, you know, me and my relationship with God. And if you do that with theology, this is about me finding about God. Then there's something quite wrong with that, because actually it seems to me that we do this as part of the church. And therefore, when you come to theology as a Christian, you do that as part of the church, which is not just the church now, but the church down the ages. And the church down the ages has a history of the way we've done theology. And that's captured in things like the creeds. So the Nicene Creed, which we're celebrating the 1700th anniversary of this year, from 325, when it first sort of appeared, you know, is, if you like, a summary of the Bible in 175 Greek words. That's what the early fathers were trying to do. They wrestled over every single word to get it right. And we've kind of inherited that. And therefore, we read the scriptures with that framework of thought. This is what matters. These are the things that matter about the church. So I'm not just reading the Bible as if I was the first person to read it, the first Christian to read it. I'm doing it within that great tradition of Christian reflection on scripture, which is encapsulated in the creeds, in the great theologians of the past, people like St. Athanasius and St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas and Martin Luther and John Calvin. Not that they always agreed on things, but they kind of have a kind of a framework within which we do theology. And that, I think, is also the combination of prayer on the one hand, that personal encounter with God that makes you realize that theology is not just an abstract subject, but also you're doing theology in the context of the church that has a history and has a framework for thinking about the faith. That's what kind of keeps you from drifting too far from it, and keeps it something alive and deepening your faith rather than something that ends up losing it.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think for me, discovering that sort of sense of 2,000 years of history and of the importance of the church fathers and those early creeds and all that kind of stuff, it suddenly roots you, doesn't it? You know, this is not just some idea that's been made up. I am part of this amazing stream of thought of some of the brightest people that ever lived, going back 2,000 years, and I'm proud to belong to that and to be part of that. Yes, it's again a real sadness to me that so much of the preaching I hear, just, it's like there's the Bible, we take the Bible very seriously, and then there's this sort of 2,000 years of nothing happens, and then all of a sudden, here I am, and God says, you know, for 2,000 years it's as though the Almighty has been shaking his head, and it's all terrible. And then, lo and behold, suddenly, here's somebody who believes the Bible.
Exactly. Yeah, it's why somebody's, I'm quite glad to be an Anglican in a way. I didn't grow up as an Anglican, as I say, I grew up as a Baptist in my parents' home. But you know, I guess as Anglicans, we think of ourselves as a Reformed Catholic Church. So we are, you know, part of the old church that's always been here in England, right from the very, very earliest days. They're believing those things that are handed down to us from the creeds. We don't, but we went through a Reformation in the 16th century. The aspects of the medieval church we thought were just going in the wrong direction, and therefore we kind of reset the church. And therefore, I think, you know, Anglicanism at its best has that sense of, you know, that long tradition of the church handed on down to us, but reformed in the way that Protestants did that. I think if you take out the Catholic bit and you just have the Protestant bit, then I think there is that tendency to think, well, then nothing really important happened in the last 2,000 years, and I can read the Bible as if I was the first person to read it. And that doesn't really work.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I wanted to ask about, you know, I think a lot of evangelicals in particular who aren't Anglicans look at the Church of England sometimes without much understanding of it and presume or assume it's kind of dwindling in this kind of liberal, progressive, more heterodox direction. What's your experience, having trained a lot of vicars in your time, trainee vicars in Oxford and in London, and then as a bishop? Do you think the Church of England remains kind of rooted in orthodoxy? Or even more orthodox than it may have been in the 80s, when you had bishops kind of openly questioning things like the resurrection?
Yeah, it's worth pondering that for a moment, as you say, Tim, you know, there was the famous thing where David Jenkins, the Bishop of Durham, although he was probably a lot misunderstood, but he certainly expressed himself in such a way that made it seem that he was actually questioning the historicity of the resurrection, or that the resurrection was a real thing that happened in history and time. It seemed to be that he was saying it was something that was more that happened to the disciples themselves in their hearts and minds, rather than something that actually affected the body of Jesus, which is not something, you know, which is something that is crucial to Christian faith. So, you know, we can sometimes overestimate the sort of drift of Anglican theology. And you think of someone like a Rowan Williams, for example, who in many ways is, you know, deeply orthodox in his regard for scripture, in the fathers, in the great tradition of the Christian faith. And people like him and Tom Wright, and other kind of really significant figures in the kind of, you know, bishops within the Church of England who have held to a kind of Christian orthodoxy in that way. Now, obviously, at the moment, we're having pretty significant debates around the question of sort of human sexuality, where many would see a drift towards a more kind of liberal, progressive direction within the Church of England. That's not universal. And part of our issue we're at the moment is this church is split right down the middle on it. So it's not like the whole of the church is drifting in one particular direction. There's a real debate going on, and quite the outcome of that, I think, is still to be determined. And so, yes, there is a bit of a struggle going on right now as to what is happening with our debates on sexuality. Is that a kind of move away from Christian orthodoxy, or is it something that people would argue would be kind of a sort of legitimate expression of it? I think I'm more on the former than I am on the latter on that question. But that's a debate we're having right now. But actually, when you get to things like the doctrine of the incarnation, the resurrection, the atonement, yeah, you'll find various views on those within the Church of England. But there's quite a lot of orthodoxy within the Church of England still, I think.
It strikes me there's almost kind of two parallel moves at once, where the Church of England has kind of turned the page a little bit on some of the excesses of kind of liberal heterodoxy from the second half of the 20th century. And as you say, it's pretty rare to find a senior bishop or an archdeacon or someone who would quite openly dispute kind of creedal orthodoxy. But at the same time, there's continuing pressure in kind of to develop kind of social and ethical teaching in a way. And as you say, the kind of debate is to what extent can new developments when it comes to, you know, blessings for gay couples and things like that, can that be contained within the 39 articles and kind of traditional Anglican orthodoxy, or as some would argue, does it burst the boundaries? But at the same time, it is, as you say, quite rare to find senior church leaders kind of openly questioning or dismissing elements of the creeds and traditional orthodoxy.
No, I think that is right. And I can't think of bishops or senior figures at the moment within the church who would openly question those tenets of Christian orthodoxy. I guess the question, I think, around the sexuality question, I think, you know, for many conservatives, the reason why it's a kind of touch point issue is because a Christian understanding of marriage is an expression of and kind of emerges from the doctrines of creation and redemption, which is why it's such a sort of key issue for many people within that. So I think it's trying to work out what are the relationships between those ethical issues and the kind of doctrinal convictions that we have, and working those things through. And I think we're in the process of trying to work those things through right now.
One of the things that sort of concerns me about this current debate going on in the Church of England, and actually wider in so much of the church, is this complete obsession with sexuality, as though, you know, the single most important issue facing mankind as we go into the 21st century is our issues of sexuality. And, you know, I just think that is so distorted. And it's almost as though the church has taken on the sexual obsession of the age, or of the previous age, you know, a kind of Freudian, and then becomes down that rabbit hole, as though sexual identity, sexual expression, you know, this is the essence of what it means to be human. Whereas I, you know, surely that, you know, when I look across at the outer world, and I'm just thinking of the kind of issues we're facing at the moment of sort of globalization, rules-based order, warfare, you know, artificial intelligence, technology, you know, economy and so on, immigration, you know. And then you say, well, so where is the church's voice? Where is the Christian voice, you know, really engaging with these issues? You know, now I'm just interested as to why, again, why have we become so obsessed with sex? Why are these other issues seen as relatively less important?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose my take on that is, I think the reason why the church is debating these things right now is because our culture has become quite fixated on sex and sexual identity being sort of core to who we are. And that's kind of something that goes back to Freud and beyond that as well. And therefore, the church is trying to kind of work out what does it say to that sort of sense of that's where our kind of core identity comes from. Because I guess what you get with Freud is to say that, you know, well, our true identity comes from within. It comes from our desires. It comes from what happens within ourselves. And because for Freud, our deepest desires are sexual, that gives us the ultimate understanding of who we are. And I think, you know, the church is probably belatedly trying to kind of work out, okay, what do we make of that? What do we think of it? And it's having to wrestle with that question. I agree with you, John. I think actually to make this the one issue that is above all else seems to be a crazy thing. And it's one of the ironies of our time at the moment, I think, is that just when we are beginning to see perhaps the openness, the kind of, you know, turning towards faith in many, especially in the younger generation, the church is tearing itself apart over sexuality, over a kind of internal debate, which may be necessary that we have that, but it's consuming so much energy and so much time that it's not giving enough space for the church to respond to the really yearnings of the age. So, you know, I think I don't want to say let's just forget about it and let's not think about it, because I think we have to, because it's a crucial issue within the wider self-understanding of people. But to spend all our energy on that seems to be a bit of a mistake right now.
Have you ever found yourself in a conversation about faith and struggled to find the right words? Maybe you've been challenged by tough questions and felt unprepared to respond. That's why our Confident Christianity course was created. It's an interactive online course designed to help you understand and share your faith with clarity and conviction. You'll gain the knowledge and skills to engage in meaningful conversations and confidently defend what you believe. Right now, you can get access to this powerful course as a special thank you for your gift to Premier Insight today. Your generosity helps bring resources like this to more people seeking truth. Get access today and start equipping yourself for those important moments. Just visit premierinsight.org/confident. That's premierinsight.org/confident.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Or let's touch on that point since you raise it. I guess the most recently work, since you stepped down as a serving bishop in the Church of England, has been with the Centre for Cultural Witness, and you kind of describe that as, I guess, trying to, you know, see cultural issues, see what society is wrestling with through Christian spectacles. Was that motivated because you think there is a greater openness, or because you think actually the world has lost touch with what the Christian tradition says? Does it come from a sense of optimism that people are ready to listen now, having kind of put behind a spasm of new atheism?
I mean, to be honest, it didn't really emerge from that. I think that kind of move away from the new atheism, the kind of rediscovery or new openness to faith, is really something that's come onto our horizon really in the last couple of years, almost since we started the centre. I'm not necessarily saying it's because we started the centre, but it's interesting that it's kind of coincided with that. I think where it came from in my own mind was I was very aware as a bishop, looking across the churches I was responsible for, which was about 100 parishes across West London, many of whom were doing really, really good work at trying to share the love of Christ in their different communities, either through their evangelism, with their Alpha courses or whatever, or through practical action with sort of with, you know, food banks, or seeking to reach out to people through kind of homeless ministries or whatever it might be, trying to express the love of Christ in places. But it was quite hard work in a way. It was like you were sort of sowing the seed of the gospel on fairly stony ground. And I think, you know, there are parts of the world where you could sow the seed of the gospel and you'll get a pretty instant response straight away. But in Western Europe, countries like the United Kingdom, maybe the USA at the moment, it's a sense that, you know, we're sowing the seed of the gospel on, you know, to use the language of the parable of the sower, on sort of either thin ground or stony ground, which isn't really well prepared to receive the seed. And so therefore, I kind of felt increasingly we need to do not just more sowing of the seed, we need to do that. Yes, we need to kind of preach the gospel and run our alpha courses and everything else, but we need to do a bit of kind of preparing of the ground, if you like, which means preparing people to opening people's mind to the possibility of God. We sometimes talk about the Center for Culture Witnesses is what we're trying to do is to awaken a longing for God in culture. One of the things that Pascal said about, you know, how you approach people, and just written a biography of Blaise Pascal. And one of the things he said was, you know, he said, when you're trying to convince someone of Christian faith, just make it attractive, make good people wish it was true, and then show that it is. Now, that thing about, you know, making good people wish it was true, that seems to be a vital step in the direction of helping people to discover Christian faith. Even before they think it's true, what happens if they begin to wish it was true? There's something about this that makes me think, you know, even if I don't believe it, I don't understand it, but I sort of somehow wish it was true because it's such an attractive story. And so it seems to me that what we were trying to do was do that very thing, almost making people wish it was true by portraying a picture of Christian faith that is so attractive, so rich, so, that can make sense of the world so much, so well, that people think, well, even if I don't believe it, I kind of almost wish it was true. And then if you get that sort of atmosphere, then the preaching of the gospel is much more likely to yield fruit, it seems to me. And a part of that, I think, is trying to show how Christian faith makes a huge difference to the way you see everything. Everything looks different when you see it through the Christian faith. And if this world is a world in which, that God made this world, he didn't come here by accident, and therefore this world is one which tells you something about the nature of God. If this is a world in which God has actually become incarnate and become a human being and walked upon this planet, what does that mean for our view of the world? If Jesus Christ has died for the sins of the world so they can be forgiven, what does that mean? What if this is a world in which death has been overcome through the resurrection of Christ? What does all that make? What difference does all that make for the way you read your newspaper and read the websites that you do every day? So that seemed to be a crucial question. So it's not direct evangelism, but it's kind of preparing for the work of evangelism, I think, that we're what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and I sort of have so resonated. When I remember when I first heard that quote from Pascal, I just thought it was just a bang, yeah, that's it. And so often the problem is that what the Christianity that is presented isn't attractive. It seems actually, you know, over dogmatic, life defying, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And are we surprised if people say, actually, you know, I prefer a good healthy dose of hedonism. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Which is why one of the main things we do in the Center for Culture Witness is this website called seenandunseen.com. And we said right from the beginning on that, we wanted to, all of our writers always write for the person outside the church, not for the person inside. There are lots of things that do stuff for Christians and help them think about how do you pray or how do you organize your church. That's fine. But we always wanted to write for the person outside the church. And that's partly so that it's the kind of thing that someone outside the church could read and think, okay, that's interesting. That gives me a new angle on stuff that I haven't seen before. Also stuff that people who do have a faith could pass on to their friends and say, look, here's an article on Donald Trump or on the Russia-Ukraine war. Have a look at this and see what you think. And it might open their minds to the fact that Christian faith might make a difference to the way you see the world. But also so that it helps Christians do that work of relating faith to culture so that their faith is integrated into their lives much more coherently. And really, that's what I think we were trying to do in it all, by making it attractive, by showing how Christian faith makes a difference to the way you see everything.
And sort of just taking it forward, I'd be very interested in your view of what is going on in the secular culture and the sort of different trends. It seems very complex, perhaps it always is, but you can see both positive and negative trends in people's attitudes towards Christianity, different kind of movements going on. It certainly feels very different from the kind of intellectual environment I remember from the 70s, 80s, and the new atheism, really, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, that kind of stuff. It's a very different zeitgeist now, isn't it?
Yeah, there is. And I think, quite recently, we're recording this in sort of early April 2025, whenever people are listening to it. But there's recently come out a report from the Bible Society saying how there's a kind of turning towards Christian faith. It's giving hard evidence to what has been anecdotal so far, that particularly younger people, particularly younger men, interestingly enough, are actually turning towards the faith. Actually, numbers are going up in terms of connecting with faith, particularly interestingly enough, within the Roman Catholic and Pentecostal churches rather than the Anglican one, which is a makes me think a bit about my own faith, my own sort of church as well. But I think that's quite interesting. And I think the reason for it is because I think a lot of the secular ideologies or frameworks have kind of been found wanting. That they've just really not delivered. If you think of in the 20th century, I guess the two great creeds that dominated the 20th century were sort of fascism and communism. And fascism came to an end in the end of the Second World War and was revealed to be the kind of destructive and dead end that it was. Communism kind of came to an end in 1989 when the Berlin Wall fell, and that was no longer seen to be the route to freedom and the kind of things that it promised to give. You then had what is sometimes called the Francis Fukuyama moment, where he published his article and book saying it was the end of history and that the future was with sort of liberal, secular, free market democracies. That was the way ahead. That was the only game in town. And even now that seems to be a little bit lame, because with the financial crashes of 2008 and beyond, the market didn't seem to deliver something that was fair and equitable for people. You also had the rise of populism with Trump and Erdogan and Turkey and Bolsonaro and Brazil and so on. So the whole liberal project seemed to be threatened at the same time. You have the new atheism, but again, everyone's tired of that now because they were kind of too angry and too aggressive and too doctrinaire in it all. So I think there's a lot of people kind of looking around and thinking, well, none of these things quite work anymore. What else is there? And actually, Christianity is still around, lying in the rubble, and it's still there 2,000 years later, and actually seems to give a kind of wisdom and a kind of long-standing sense of history that or of something that's been tried and tested over generations that people are turning to. There was a phrase that the musician Nick Cave used in an article, in an interview he gave to the Times some while ago, where he was asked the question, God seems to be on the agenda again now, and these public figures seem to be turning to God. What's going on? And why do you think that is? And he said, it's a little phrase that it seemed to capture it quite well. He said, well, people always need meaning, and the secular world hasn't come up with the goods. I thought that really captured it. You know, there is a deep human need for meaning. We cannot live a life that doesn't have any sense of meaning or significance. We need our lives to mean something, and we need to find it somewhere. But actually, the secular options just have seemed to have failed us. And so that's why maybe we're beginning to see the possibility of a turn towards faith. I think it's too early to talk about revival or that kind of language, but maybe that's what's going on.
It's really interesting because I just in the last few weeks have been researching an article I'm writing about TikTok and evangelism and Christian ministry on TikTok, and talking, particularly looking at people who are trying to reach kind of Gen Z as teenagers, young adults in their 20s. And what was fascinating is a lot of those exactly the same ideas came out, in that the assumption, I think, from people of my age and above is that the young people will be kind of repelled by the church and abuse scandals and hypocrisy and institutional religion. And actually, a lot of the people I'm speaking to who are actively trying to do apologetics and evangelism on this very, very modern, fast-moving video sharing platform say that actually there's a kind of sense in which people are desperate to find meaning. You know, someone talked about the bankruptcy of kind of modern secularism and that it doesn't really offer you any foundation to stand on. You know, this kind of your truth, my truth, post-truth is kind of empty and facile. And people are actually yearning for something more substantial. And so there actually is quite receptive ground for to say, well, have you thought about Jesus? Have you considered whether this 2,000-year-old tradition might offer you a better source of meaning, a more grounded sense of identity and purpose in life?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I sometimes say that I feel like there are three things our contemporary world, maybe always human beings are looking for is a sense of history, a sense of home, and a sense of hope. In other words, you know, we need a sense of history. We need a story into which our lives fit, and especially one ideally that kind of has a bit of longevity to it. It's not just a brand new idea off the press and then the latest sort of website or out of some influencer somewhere. It's got a bit of history to it. We need to fit into a history. Now, we need a sense of feeling at home, being in a place where we feel we're not going to be shouted at, where there's a sense of welcome, there's a sense of, yeah, I feel at home here. But we also desperately need hope for the future. We cannot live without hope. Human life is not built to live without hope. If you have no hope, all you have is despair. And that's what the lack of hope means. You know, in French, it's désespoir, you know, the lack of espoir, hope. And so to me, those are the very things that actually Christian faith offers. It offers a sense of history. It's a story that is rooted in the past. It offers a sense of coming home to the God who made you and who beckons you back home again, the prodigal son story. And it offers hope in the sense of the resurrection. There's something that is rooted in history that gives a sense of a prospect of a new heaven and a new earth that you can't imagine, but that's kind of part of the point. That it is beyond imagination, even sort of better than the imagination. So I think for those reasons, I think Christian faith is really increasingly a viable option for many people who are fed up with, as you say, the bankruptcy of what else is on offer out there today.
I think this is where Pascal is interesting as well, because obviously you know much better than I do, but my understanding is that one of his key insights was that rather than using the medieval arguments for the existence of God and so on, he saw that it was the power of the paradoxes of the faith. And that's a message which has resonated very much with me as somebody who's tried to defend Christian thinking and Christian ethics in a secular medical and ethical world, is that if I make Christianity seem common sense, I destroy its power. And actually, rather than to downplay the paradoxes, what I should do is emphasize them. You know, it's the ridiculous nature of Christianity, the fact that God turns himself into a baby and so on and so on, that that in bondage we find freedom and in submission we find ourselves and so on and so on. It's those paradoxes which make absolutely no sense at one level and yet resonate, I think, with secular people.
I think that's absolutely right, John. And that is exactly what Pascal does. He glories in the paradoxes of Christianity. In fact, in the biography which I've just written, which is called Blaise Pascal, The Man Who Made the Modern World, published by Hodder, £25. There's a chapter in it called Christianity is Strange. It's a quote from Pascal. He just says, you know, Christianity is strange. It is not obvious. In fact, actually, he says, you know, nature, science doesn't prove God. He said you can look into kind of scientific understanding and it doesn't give you some nice, neat argument that God exists. In fact, he says there's no, you know, apart from faith, you can't really tell whether we've been created by God or by some demon or whatever. But he then goes, he plays with that paradox and he says there's enough order within the world to make us think that it's not just random. It's not totally kind of, you know, everything can't be, not everything can be deconstructed. There is an order within the world that might suggest that God is there. But on the same time, there isn't enough evidence to really kind of convince that. So therefore, he says, well, if there is a God, it must be a hidden God, a God who's present but not obvious to us. And then he makes the point and say, well, actually, that's precisely what you see when you look at Jesus. Because when you look at Jesus, you could actually meet Jesus and completely miss the fact that you were meeting God. You could shake hands with Jesus and completely miss the fact that you were shaking hands with the Son of God, because God was hidden in Jesus, in the flesh of Jesus. He just seemed like an ordinary human being. So that's the very nature of the God that Christians talk about, a hidden God. And he talks about how, you know, Christian faith makes so much sense of the kind of complexities of our world. And it's interesting, in a in the, you know, sort of culture wars that we live in at the moment. You know, there was a kind of 17th century culture war between rationalists and skeptics. Rationalists like Descartes, who said you can understand the world by the use of human reason. Skeptics, people like Michel de Montaigne from a century before. Descartes was a contemporary of Pascal, but Montaigne was a century before. But Montaigne was saying, actually, no, you can't really know much about the world at all. We have to kind of resort to skepticism. There's no such thing as truth out there that you can really grasp in any kind of firm sense. So how do you kind of resolve this complexity of the rationalist and the skeptic? You know, there's too much to doubt, but not enough to believe. And he says, well, actually, Christian faith can make sense of that because it says that we are both created and fallen. It makes sense of our greatness as human beings, that we are capable of understanding a huge amount. We're capable of great acts of compassion and creativity and art and technology, but we're also capable of great cruelty and destruction and so on. How do you make sense of this mystery that is humanity, this paradox, this glory and refuse of the universe, as he calls us? He said the only way you can understand that is by Christian faith. It gives you a kind of framework for making sense of these things. So I think you're absolutely right. That's why Pascal is such a modern thinker in many ways and such a modern apologist, because he understands where modern people are coming from in a way that maybe they didn't a couple of centuries before. I think he speaks really powerfully to our age.
And do you think we struggle with that in the modern church, kind of leaning into the paradoxical elements of faith? Or are we too quick, particularly, I think, those of us from an evangelical background, to try and delineate and put forward a systematic theology of neat lines and squares and flow diagrams, and this is exactly how atonement works, and this is exactly how the Trinity works, and there's a, it feels safer and more comprehensible, but there's a sense that we're kind of trying to box God in to an extent.
Yeah, and it comes over as a bit facile and not terribly satisfying in the end. St. Augustine once said, if I can understand it, it's not God. And if we can sort of somehow capture everything in some nice neat formula, we've missed out on something crucial. And the other thing I think Pascal does for us is he's very modern in the sense that he lives in a world where the microscope and the telescope have relatively recently been invented. He lives in the middle of the 17th century, born in 1623, died in 1662. So he has these passages where he writes about what it is to kind of look into the vastness of space through the telescope that, early in that century was, Galileo's developed it, and others before him as well. And he suddenly helps people to understand how actually modern human beings feel very insignificant and quite lost within a universe that doesn't appear to be made around us. Maybe before that, we sense that before the whole Copernican revolution, realizing that actually it was the sun was the center of the universe, not the earth, we kind of felt the universe was made for us. The earth is the center of everything. Now we kind of feel a bit on the edges of the universe. We feel this universe is a vast place. We're one tiny little planet within one particular galaxy. We're one tiny little specks of life on that little planet, which seems like we're totally insignificant. And yet we can't live like that. We kind of have to have a sense that we are significant. And some of his descriptions are very kind of modern in that sense of looking into the vastness of space and realizing how insignificant we are, and yet trying to make sense of that with this sense that we do feel ourselves to be significant. And again, that's one of the things why how he kind of understands how Christian faith makes sense of it. So I think he can speak to the kind of sense of lostness of a lot of people today, but actually give a sense of meaning and hope within that very lostness, because that's exactly what he understands the dilemmas of what it's like to live as a sort of modern person on the other side of the scientific revolution.
And just lastly, then, as a kind of cynical journalist, I'm often quite skeptical of Christians who proclaim, the tide is turning and revival is coming and the winter is thawing, because it feels like something we'd all desperately want to be true, having all grown up, in generations of church decline and secularism, and it feels a bit too close to wishful thinking. What would it take, do you think, for you to actually, you mentioned there's this Bible Society research that come out this week, which looks very interesting and encouraging. What would it take for you to kind of really start to believe that hypothesis that we are turning a corner on Western secularism and there is a genuine return to faith, what would it take for you to really start to think that that might actually be grounded in truth?
Yeah, I mean, you'd need a lot sort of harder evidence, a lot of studies suggesting significant shifts. I think what we're seeing perhaps is some straws in the wind that may be the sign of a kind of, you know, new wind blowing through our culture. But I think it's too early to say. But I think in some ways, the crucial thing about it is that the truth of Christian faith doesn't depend on numbers. And that's what I slight fear about this. It's obviously, you know, this is a confirmation, you know, we're right after all, because people are turning back to faith. Excuse me, Christian faith is true, whether people believe it or not. And I think that's crucial. And numbers, you can always, you can go too far on numbers. It seems to me that, you know, you can do statistics and a sense of probabilities and what might happen in the future. But I mean, statistical analysis of what happens to dead people would never have predicted the resurrection. And so therefore, Christian faith is something that statistics are useful, they're helpful, and they're good. They might make us feel, okay, it's good that people are beginning to recognize Christian faith, but they don't affect the truth of Christian faith. And I think the calling for Christians, whether the numbers are good or bad, is to kind of return back to the sources of our faith and the joy that it brings and the sense of life and energy and fullness and the richness of the view of the world that the Christian faith offers, and live out that as confidently as we can and joyfully as we can, whether or not everyone else follows us or not.
Well, that sounds like a great place to draw a conversation to a close. Thank you so much, Graham. It's been brilliant chatting with you. If people want to find out a bit more about Seen and Unseen, what's the website again?
Seenandunseen.com. And if you go there, you'll find new articles every day, usually 5 or 10 articles every week, a whole series of podcasts as well, particularly one called Reenchanting, which is a really good podcast, very popular these days, and just gives you perspectives on all the kind of issues that are talking about, people are talking about in the news. If it's in the news, there's probably an article in there helping you to think about how Christian faith might help you see that issue differently, and material you might want to pass on to other people, you'll read for yourself, and hopefully it's a real resource in helping to portray and to kind of communicate Christian faith today.
And the Pascal book, remind us the title of that.
Yeah, the Pascal book is called Blaise Pascal, The Man Who Made the Modern World, published by Hodder, and available in all good bookshops and good websites. But yeah.
Brilliant. All right, well, do look up those two things. Thanks so much, Graham. Thank you, everyone, for listening. As always, you can find lots of other interesting stuff, probably not quite as comprehensive as Seen as Unseen, but on Dad's website, that's johnwyatt.com. And you can find some of my journalism on my website, that's tswyatt.com. If you've got any thoughts or reflections on what Graham and we've been talking about, we'd love to hear your comments or suggestions for other people we should have on the show. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. But otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. Prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.